dive into actual facts and a discussion of the real issues that are shaping our world today. Instead of getting lost in the chaff, Duncan Campbell has been able to put together a program where we talk about facts, we talk about reality, and we talk about solutions. He's made it his life work. I've made it my life work. I hope you will make it your life work. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Welcome once again to Living Dialogues. I'm Duncan Campbell, and I'm truly delighted to have with me as my dialogue partner once again, Stefan Schwartz, the author of The Daily Schwartz Report, which once again you can subscribe to for free. Just Google Schwartz Report, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, Report. And it is a wonderful opportunity to share the great tracking ability and trend spotting that Stefan Schwartz has cultivated over his many years of research and public service and amazing variety of fields. But without going into those complex fields, let's just take advantage of the fruit of the life of Stefan Schwartz. And he put it at the end of part one in a very concise daily pledge that we could all take to actually tune in to what's really happening and what we can do and how we can gauge our level of presence and attentiveness and contribution to life-affirming action during each day. And he calls it the quotidian pledge. So let's repeat that again to begin this part two, Stefan.
Well, this arises, let me, by way of background, let me tell a small story about Gandhi. You know, Gandhi was the only man to get independence for his country without a war. And it's really quite extraordinary if you think about it.
Yes.
And just before he was assassinated, a reporter came up to him at his ashram and said to him, you know, "Oh, Gandhiji, my editor sent me up here and he just wants me to ask one question." And Gandhi said, "Well, what's the question?" And the reporter said, "The question is, how did you force the British to leave India? India was the crown jewel of their empire. I mean, the queen is the empress of India. How did you force the British to leave? You had no army, you had no official position, you had no particular money. You dealt mostly with impoverished people. How did you do that?" And Gandhi's answer makes the point of the quotidian pledge. He said, "It wasn't what we did that mattered, although that mattered. It wasn't what we said that mattered, although that mattered too. What really did it was the nature of our character, our beingness, that led the British to choose to leave India." That's a really powerful statement, if you think about it for a minute. So the quotidian pledge arises from that Gandhian statement. And it basically says, every day you make dozens of little choices. You choose the food you buy, you choose the toothpaste you buy, you choose the gasoline you buy, you choose the kind of car. I mean, all of those are little choices. They're little votes. And so the first thing you need to do is to become aware that you're making choices. Many people don't. They think, "Oh, what difference could it possibly make what kind of toothpaste I buy?" But it does make a difference, and here's how. So every day become aware that you're making choices and that those choices are votes for things you either support or don't support. And of the options that are available at every choice point, you commit to always choose consistently the one that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being. Now, none of the choices may be great choices, but inevitably one of them is always a little better than the others. And so that's the one you choose. And you do it as a discipline, and you tell 10 of your friends that you're doing this, and you invite them to tell 10 to do it with you, and you invite them to tell 10 of their friends, and so forth. Well, you can see very quickly how this adds up. We know from research that was done at Van Rensselaer Polytech that when 10% of any cohort and the scale doesn't matter whether it's a church group or a nation, when 10% of the cohort change in consciousness, the other 90% of the cohort have to change to accommodate to that. And you can actually see this in happening. Just to give you a couple of very quick examples. When you and I were boys, you went over to somebody's house and there was always an ashtray on the coffee table with a pack of cigarettes and one of those Ronson lighters your mother told you not to fool with. So you don't see that anymore. Why is that? It's not that the president got on television and made a speech about it, or the Pope came out and made a speech about it. No, the reason it stopped was evidence came out about smoking and cancer, and people just made the tiny little daily choice, I'm not going to do that anymore. And so you don't see those coffee tables laden with cigarettes and ashtrays and Ronson lighters. It just doesn't happen. Or another one is, look at the transformation from gay to LGBT, which is not only a change in term, but it can change in a complete conceptualization about what gender actually means. And if you go back and do a Google word search, you go back about 2.5 years and you see very quickly, in a relatively short space of time, there was this complete flip from gay to LGBT. Again, nobody came out and passed a law. Nobody made a public statement of that it had to be done. It's just that individuals, when they sat down to write the word gay, said, you know, LGBT would really be better, and that's what they used. You can see it in the Me Too movement. I mean, we think that we are, as individuals, powerless. What can we do? I don't have any money. I don't have a big position. You know, what could I possibly do? And the answer is, if you always make choices which support compassion and well-being, and your neighbors and other people around you do that as well, then consciousness changes, and when that happens, the system must change. That's what Gandhi understood. And so I am encouraging people to take the quotidian pledge, and just the people that are listening, I mean, you think about this for a minute, just the people that are listening to this program, I don't know how many of them there are, but you multiply that by 10, and then you multiply that by 10, and you just keep going. And pretty soon, you're in about 6 leaps, you're up into millions. So if 10% are required to change the course of history, if we have 318 million people, roughly, in the United States, so we need to get 31 million of them to change. To give you another example, I live on an island that has 26,000 people on it, and we have completely different social outcomes, divorce, obesity, drug addiction, all that sort of thing, than we should have given the economic level of the island. It's a little rural island off the coast of Washington. And the reason is that about 2,600 people in our community have committed themselves to creating a compassionate, well-being fostering social structure with all kinds of little non-governmental support groups. And so it's completely changed the consciousness and culture of the island. And we can do that at the national level, and we can do it by November and change the whole course of history, because if we don't do it, nobody else is going to do it for us. That's what I think both you and I agree upon. And I wrote in this book, The Eight Laws of Change, I wrote this book because 4 times in my life I've been involved with changing history. And I've paid attention to how that works. And I've done a lot of research, about 18 years worth of research on this. And just to give you again one tiny little example, you look at the Quakers. The Quakers, there are less than 87,000 Quakers in the United States. In the whole of American history dating back to the colonial period, they're less than 500,000. And it's such a tiny little group of people that most people have never met a Quaker, have no idea what they believe or what their religious services are like, or they just don't have any idea except they know that there's a face on the oatmeal box. So you would think that that's such a tiny group that couldn't possibly have any big effect on the country. And yet, if you look at every major social transformational movement that is well-being oriented, that has occurred in the, over the 200 plus years of American history, what you see is that it began with a tiny little group of Quakers, because this group has figured out how you do this. It's not a secret. It's just that I think it's hard for people to understand that ordinary people have enormous power when they hold collective intention. And the key to this is coalescing collective intention that smiles and leans toward the direction of well-being. And it's possible, as I say, for just the people listening to this program to change the course of history for the better if they are willing to do it.
So let me make a couple of comments. The first is with respect to democracy, because one of our themes here is how do we go beyond our falling apart, breaking down, and self-imploding democracy 1.0 as set up by the 1% men of property founding fathers with a Senate that really gives inordinate power to people that are very not representative of the whole. So there are people that, for instance, in the red states and, say, North and South Dakota, each one under a million people have four senators. California has 43 million people, has two senators, and so on. So there will always be this disparity within our institutions and our expression of public policy in favor of a rural-based populace, which at the moment is represented in their coalesced collective consciousness by Donald Trump. And Donald Trump's character, going back to Gandhi and his intentionality, is not life-affirming, is not in the kind of orientation that you've talked about with the Quakers or the people on your own island. And he has solid 40% backing.
That's right. He is the negative proof of the theorem.
He is the negative proof of the theorem. And here's what I wanted to say about de Tocqueville and democracy, because at the moment, our democracy is being completely vitiated by Trump and his tweets. There's no counter to his tweets. There's no counter leader that is tweeting every day, or any source, doesn't have to be a leader, but tweeting every day the life-affirming alternatives and encouraging that consciousness to grow. And so what we're seeing is really the deterioration and destruction of the possibilities that our governing structures could bring forth. Now, this was recognized in an interesting way by Alexis de Tocqueville, where what he observed was different about America and democracy was not just this idea of voting and structures like the House of Representatives and the Senate and lifetime judiciary. What he noticed was different between the ancien regime that he had written a book on in Europe, which would be the old regime, the feudal hierarchy, the separation between aristocrats and the serfs and the king and the monarchy and so on, that what was really the life-affirming spirit and the innovation and the thing that inspired him about America were voluntary associations, just as you described, has enlivened and created a space of safety and health and well-being in your little island of 26,000 people. So there's two things about this. One is voluntary associations and coming together outside of formal legal structures and voting and that kind of thing. Although voting, of course, is going to be very, very important, crucial in this coming election, but also how the choices are made in those voluntary associations to promote health and well-being and the good of the whole. So the question I'm going to pose to you right now is, let's go back to Charlottesville, Virginia, the famous time when our president said, oh, there's really good people on both sides, and really sent a coded message of white supremacist attitude and racism to the country. Now, right there in Charlottesville, there were voluntary associations of people with white supremacist intentions that came to Charlottesville with the deliberate intent to actually prevent some of the Confederate statues and other monuments from being replaced or torn down. And they were met by citizens that were of a very different view. And we could say that the bulk of the citizens in Charlottesville, as expressed through their civic organizations, were of a different view, were wanting to actually move forward in some way and acknowledge by taking down one or two of these monuments that they had moved to a larger diversity-affirming and inclusiveness in their city. So what do you say when voluntary associations rise, like these white supremacist groups, these neo-Nazi groups, and so on, and how their power compares to the power of voluntary groups that coalesce around, let's say, a higher genuine diversity, inclusiveness, and life-affirming agenda?
Well, first of all, you have to recognize, I think, that there are four great meta trends that are going on in the world today, not just in the United States, but all over the world. The first is being born white will no longer confer privilege. That's the first. Second one is being born male will no longer automatically bestow dominance. The third one is North American and Western European culture values are not the only way the world is going to organize itself now. And the fourth one is the transfer of real power from the nation state to the corporate state. And all of this is producing an enormous amount of fear. And all of these people are in a kind of fear fugue. We have about a third of the country about 27% of the country have overactive right amygdalas. That's a little almond-sized gland in your brain, which deals with fight or flight. And when it is activated, rational thought stops. And it correlates very strongly with conservative religiosity and conservative politics. So you recognize that you've got about a third of the country who are in a state of fear. And that fear is producing hate and anger. They fear that they are losing the world that they know. They fear that they're losing their status. They fear that we are, because we are becoming and will by the somewhere in the 2040s, we will become a majority-minority country. All of that is driving these people crazy. It's why the evangelicals and the rise of Christofascism, it's how an evangelical can listen to a man who is a compulsive liar, who's a sociopath, who's a molester of women. All the things that they say that they are opposed to, that they are family values people, and yet they support unwaveringly a man who violates virtually every tenet that they have. Well, how could they possibly do that? And the answer is because these people are in a state of fear. They are angry and filled with rage that they are losing their position, their status, their authority, and they have coalesced. And whenever 10% of the population coalesces in a common intention, then everybody else has got to accommodate to that. And that's what's happening. We have about a third of the country who are basically crazy. I mean, they're so frightened. Mm-hmm. They're so fearful. They're so angry. That's why they're obsessed with the Second Amendment. All of that. I mean, all of the gun stuff. I mean, you know, we lose 92 people a day in the United States to gunfire, 460 people a week, 33,000 people a year. There's no other country in the world that has anything remotely like that. And yet it's a third rail in politics. You can hardly say anything about it. Why? Because guns give these people a sense that they are less fearful. I've got my gun. I talked to a retired Army major who's been a friend for many years, and I discovered that he had a concealed carry permit. And I said to him, what is so scary in your life that you go down to the grocery store armed? Doesn't that strike you as strange that you would feel compelled to carry a gun when you went to the gas station or the dentist? Really? And he became very upset with me about it and said, well, you just know this is very dangerous, and it's a dangerous country, and I want to be able to protect myself and my family. I could not get him to see that his response was completely incommensurate with the stimulus that he was getting, and that it was arising because of this fear state. He's a conservative, religious man, and all of that is just, it's making him crazy. So one of the things that we have to do is that those of us who are not in that fear state, we also have to coalesce. That's the problem. We have about a third of the country who are really focused. They are holding a clear and common intention. This, I describe this in the 8 laws of why this is so powerful. You think, well, it's just a group of people, and they don't even know each other. How could they possibly be that powerful? But it's because they hold a common intention. That's the key to making social transformation. When you hit a critical mass of people holding a common intention, good or bad, then things happen. And so those of us who have a life-affirming, compassionate, wellness-fostering worldview, we must become similarly coalesced. Now, whether we can do it or not, it's a toss-up. Because, you know, one of the problems is that so many people just feel powerless. Oh, I can't do anything. Who cares what I think? I'm just an ordinary guy, and, you know, I don't have any power. And so they just kind of give up. That's why we have such low voting rates in the United States compared to other countries. Another part of the problem is 64% of Americans have never been outside of America. And so they have absolutely no idea what the rest of the world is like, except watching, I don't know, Anthony Bourdain, who's really quite good, but you know, I mean, it's all sort of at a remove, third hand. Most Americans, because they've never been outside of the United States, a majority, really have no idea. It's like health care. We don't have health care in the United States. We have an illness profit system. The point of the system is to produce profit, and it doesn't really matter whether you get well or you don't. I mean, cancer patients are an enormously profitable body of people to treat. Most of them, or many of them, die, and that's unfortunate, but they're very profitable. So we have an illness profit system. We don't have a healthcare system. And when you go to other countries and you talk to people who have a real healthcare system, universal healthcare, you find there's this enormous relaxation. There's this sense of it'll get dealt with. I can get the support I need. Whereas in America, we have medical bankruptcy. Medical bankruptcy is a phenomenon that's almost unheard of in the rest of the world. And yet it's so common in the United States that you probably know somebody. Every one of your listeners knows somebody who has been either bankrupted or near bankrupted as a result of some kind of medical event in their family. We need to make this decision that the function of the state is to produce and foster well-being for everyone. And when we do that, everything works better, is happier, is more productive, is more... let me give you an example, Duncan. I mean, I'm a data person, so I like to deal with data, not theories. So I'll just give you one thing. In 2004, the homeless problem in San Francisco was so acute, it was like a weeping sore, and it was so expensive that the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco were just beside themselves about what to do about the homeless. And so a supervisor named Mark Farrell came up with something called the Plan to Abolish Homelessness. And it was basically simply a data-based program to provide permanent supportive housing for people that were on the streets. So by 2000, and this is in 2004, 2007, they'd implemented the program. They started with 1,818 homeless people, and the costs went up a little bit. But by 2010, 2011, the city was saving $31 million a year, largely as a result of the decrease in cost due to the 58% decrease in emergency and urgency care
costs because of people going to the hospital emergency rooms, but also as a result of the decrease of caseload on prosecutors, judges, social workers. I mean, these things have enormous ramifications. And so, as I said, by 2015, they'd seen a decline of the costs related to homelessness of 56% or a $31.5 million savings. So whenever we choose to do that which is most fostering of well-being, what we discover on the other side is that it's much, much cheaper, and that everything we are told about we can't afford to do this, it's all a lie. It's all a confection of lies in order to create profit for a few people.
Exactly. And I think this is one of the great powers of what you do with your Schwartz reports, is to actually present that data really on a daily basis from sources all around the world. And I'll just make a couple of comments on the hidebound nature of Americans, which I think is a critical piece of this. You say that 64% of Americans have never been out of the country, but that's actually an increase in what it used to be. I recall Cokie Boggs, a friend of mine that I knew when she was in school and many years ago, and she was with ABC there in the morning for years, gave a talk out here in Colorado and said that only 10% of Americans had passports. And that was like less than 20 years ago. I read recently that only 37% of U.S. senators have passports. Now, that may seem totally shocking and improbable until we remember that George W. Bush had never been outside the United States even once in his entire life, except to visit a little bit across the border in northern Mexico. So the hidebound nature of America is really key. We don't have input from other cultures to learn from, even Europeans. And when my wife and I travel and we see CNN abroad, it's an entirely different group of people than the people we see here, including Christiane Amanpour, who's like an international presence. And now she comes in once in a while for a special series. But basically, it's this lack of imagination and just simply exposure and curiosity to other things in the world. And finally, as we're coming near the end here, I'll mention Michael Moore's great movie, Where to Invade Next. And he went all around the world and he found, for instance, on themes that you've talked about, that the prison system in one of the Nordic countries is fantastic. Actually, they're treated very well, they eat well, and they actually rehabilitate themselves, as opposed to our punitive prison industrial complex. The people in Finland have an excellent educational system that inspires communitarianism and cooperation between the students and creativity. It came from the United States. And other aspects of his movie show that a lot of the good programs that other people have adopted started here in the United States, perhaps, influenced by the Quaker people you talked about or other volunteer groups that knew how to do it but got overwhelmed by the money and policy from the billionaire class. A total example of that right now is Betsy DeVos, who is ignorant and is trying to destroy America's public education system and doing so very effectively. Yeah, we're down to our last minute and a half, and I want to give you an opportunity to summarize, and then let's make an intention here that we will also do a part three. But for this program, how would you like to end it in the next minute?
Well, I'd like to end it by saying to people, A, we stand at the cusp of a historic change, and you, the listener, are going to be largely responsible for how it comes out. So vote. And second of all, start making nothing but compassionate, life-affirming choices. If we can get 10% of the country to hold that intentioned consciousness, we can change the course of history, and we are in desperate straits. If we do not do this, America, as we grew up in it, if you're over 30 or 40 years of age, the America that we grew up in is going to disappear. If we go to 2020 with Donald Trump in the White House, by that point, the world that we now know will not exist.
Beautifully said, and it's the compassionate and life-affirming and quotidian choice for well-being that each one of us can make, and then we see how that coalesces with those around us by telling 10 who in turn tell 10 of their friends. And with that, honor Stefan Schwartz and our deep listening audience, whose real attentive listening, whenever they hear this, it could be a year from now, is what's evoking this coalescing consciousness. So with great appreciation, Stefan, for your entire life work, and to our deep listening audience, we are all warmly invited to reconvene again here weekly on Living Dialogues, as well as to check out Stefan Schwartz's Daily Schwartz Report. Thank you, Stefan. It's been a deep pleasure, as always, and look forward to our next dialogue.
Me too, Duncan.
Be with us again next time on Living Dialogues. And that next time will be the 5th of August. We are off next week. There will be a concert that's going to be played here on KGNU. And so part 3 of Stefan Schwartz, August 5. Hopefully a part 4 on August 12. So you're listening here to KGNU, Boulder, Denver, with translators K229AC, Nederland, K254CH, La Porte, and K256CT, Denver, Colorado. We're going to go right now to the BBC and be with us next time on Living Dialogues.
Coming up after the news.
Hello, I'm Julie Candler with the BBC News. President Trump's foreign policy adviser during the 2016 campaign, Carter Page, has described an allegation that he conspired with the Russian government as ridiculous. Documents containing the claim have been made public by the FBI. They include applications to courts outlining Mr. Page's relationship with Russian intelligence officials, which led to him being placed under surveillance. Speaking to CNN, he denied being a Russian agent.
I've never been an agent of the foreign power in any by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I may have, back in the G20 when they were getting ready to do that in St. Petersburg, I might have participated in a few meetings that a lot of people, including people from the Obama administration, were sitting on in Geneva, Paris, et cetera. But I've never been anywhere near what's being described here.
Afghanistan's Vice President General Abdulrashid Dostum has escaped a suicide bomb attack on his return to Kabul after more than a year abroad. At least 14 people died in the explosion near the capital's airport. Here's Catherine Davis.
Crowds of people, including high-ranking officials, had gathered on the tarmac to welcome General Dostum. There was tight security for the event, which was broadcast live on television. But minutes after his convoy left the airport, an explosion occurred. The blast is said to have gone off near the main entrance, where people had also been waiting. General Dostum's return and the reason he left has been a subject of much speculation. He went to Turkey after accusations of involvement in the kidnap, rape and torture of a political rival. He's denied any wrongdoing and insists he was in Turkey for medical treatment.
The Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has said a growing scandal over the approval of substandard vaccines has crossed a moral line. He's demanded punishment for those responsible. Michael Bristow reports.
The scandal began several days ago when regulators said there were problems with a rabies vaccination from Changsheng Biotechnology. Officials then revealed the firm had been fined for another violation, this time for inoculations for whooping cough, diphtheria and tetanus. The authorities have now launched a full investigation as anxious parents reacted angrily, desperate to find out if their children had been given potentially dangerous medicine. Even China's tightly controlled media outlets were demanding a proper explanation.
The German football international Mesut Özil has said he will no longer play for Germany following criticism of his decision to be photographed alongside the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Mr. Özil, who's of Turkish origin, posted a long statement accusing the German Football Association of racism and disrespect. He said it was with a heavy heart that he had decided not to wear the national team shirt. World news from the BBC. The EU's finance commissioner has warned that the multilateral system that's been the backbone of global trade relations is under significant pressure. Pierre Moscovici told the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires that tensions were high and that the situation was threatening to escalate, even if the impact of protectionism had been limited so far. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the country must adopt multi-party democracy supported by strong institutions that respect human rights and the rule of law. Addressing a meeting of more than 50 political parties, Mr. Abiy suggested this was the only way to ensure peace and progress in the country. Will Ross reports.
Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed knows opening up the political space is the only way to stop this diverse nation of more than 100 million people from imploding. For years, the governing coalition used oppression to keep a tight grip on power. At the last election, it won every seat in parliament. The locking up of tens of thousands of people couldn't end the more than 2 years of anti-government protests. But since